Hey guys, this is Mike Mahaffey, the old bastard BJJ guy, here for BJJ Metal Models. Back in my day, we had to walk uphill in the snow both ways to get to the academy just to learn some crappy technique from a random purple belt. You kids have it so easy, because now you can just subscribe to BJJ Metal Models Premium and get tons of great audio courses to learn new techniques, enhance your mindset, and entertain yourself. You can even get personalized rolling reviews from some of your favorite BJJ Metal Models coaches, including me. It's like having your own seminar, you spoiled little whippersnappers. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to BJJ Metal Models Premium right now, get off my lawn, and go train.
Hey, welcome to BJJ Mental Models, episode 186. I'm Steve Kwan. BJJ Mental Models is your guide to a conceptual and intelligent jiu-jitsu approach. And today, this is going to be a fun one. My interview guest here is actually a former training partner of mine, although he's now moved to the other end of the country, Mr. Micah Brakefield. Micah, buddy, how are you doing?
Hey, pretty good. It's good to talk to you again. It's been a long time.
It's been a long time for sure. So why don't you tell me what you're up to these days? I mean, I know that you moved out to Ontario. I believe you're running a 10th Planet gym there, correct?
Yeah, I do that every day pretty much. It's been a really cool experience. I moved out here in October of 2020. Our grand opening was supposed to be October 10th. They announced new shutdowns that day. So they shut us down like 4 hours before our grand opening.
That's bad timing.
yeah, it wasn't the best, but luckily we were already like mid-pandemic, so I had worked it into my contract that I was going to be paid even if we were shut down, so I was in an okay position, but we didn't get to really open until like almost a year ago now, and so we've been going for like 11 months now, and it's been awesome. We have like 50 people in every class. It's been a lot of fun.
Nice. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's a 10th Planet gym, right? What's the gym name?
It's called 10th Planet Etobicoke. Etobicoke is like the furthest west suburb in Toronto.
Got it. Cool. So just a bit of background here for people who don't know, you used to live out in my neck of the woods. You used to train with me at Ascension here in the Port Coquitlam, Vancouver area. And one of the things that is really unique about you is you're the only person I know who has two completely different BJJ black belts from two completely different lineages. There's a lot of people, you know, who get their black belt from one instructor and then they switch instructors to a different one. But this is a different situation. You actually have two completely legit BJJ black belts that are totally unrelated. Why don't you talk about that for a second? Because one of yours is from the same instructor that gave me my black belt, Don Whitefield, but you also have a separate black belt as well, right?
Yeah, that was kind of when I was a purple belt under Don, I'd kind of made up my mind that I wanted to have black belts in both the Gi and 10th Planet. I always really liked 10th Planet just based on I came from wrestling and no Gi made a lot of sense to me, but I also loved the Gi and understood like all its benefits as far as like business comes. Like when you're running a program, I think the Gi works really well for kids and it's just a whole nother avenue. And I think you can be more creative if you're looking at the same problem from a bunch of different views.
Yeah, I think it's awesome, actually, that you acknowledge that and that you went out of your way to seek out credentials in that completely different fork of the art. It's something I've actually been thinking about as well, because I do feel like as I get older here, you know, my area of study in jiu-jitsu is kind of narrowed, and it would be disingenuous for me to call myself like a no-gi black belt, because I never really train no-gi. I'm almost exclusively a gi guy. And even then, even just within that, I mean, there's still very specific areas of study within the gi. So I think it's cool, just like how, you know, you might go back to university to get another degree if you're planning to expand and broaden your horizons into a different field. I think it's interesting that you've acknowledged that the areas of jiu-jitsu are like that as well, and that they require separate study.
Yeah, well, I came from like a wrestling background too, where I feel like if wrestling had black belts, I think every university wrestler is kind of a black belt. So I feel like I would like to eventually dabble in judo, but you only have so much time. But I really like a lot of the throws in judo and stuff, and would like to kind of put on my white belt again and learn from the ground up.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same. I have massive respect for judo and I love judo, but you know, as a hobbyist, I can only divide my time so many ways. You know, it almost kills me to make enough time just to train jiu-jitsu, and I don't have the bandwidth to add on another martial art without taking away from my existing training. But yeah, it's I love that idea of kind of putting on the white belt again and forking off into a brand new direction. Now, for our listeners, if they're not familiar with you by name, they've almost certainly seen you before because you're kind of a human highlight reel. I mean, I think most of our listeners here have probably seen that clip of you shooting on someone and then going into a leg inversion, coming up behind them and giving them a German suplex. And I think it was an MMA fight. Is that correct?
Yeah. The worst part is I had a calf slicer at the end of that series and I legitimately let go of it because I didn't want to be boring. And it was like when I watched it in post, like I was like, wow, that was like one of the coolest highlights you could have had. And if I would have hung on and got a submission at the end of it, it would have been like amazing. But I have like MMADD and just wanted to try and trail off onto something else.
Well, that's actually an amazing segue into what I wanted to talk about here today, which is I want to talk about unorthodoxy in jiu-jitsu and the process of being creative and innovating. Because, I mean, I've trained with you for years and your game is one of the most completely unique games in the jiu-jitsu space that I'm familiar with and that I've seen and trained with directly. There's a lot of people who do bits and pieces of what I guess you could call innovation, but a lot of what you do is completely foreign. I mean, I remember having to spar in a completely different way with you because I don't know if you've changed your game since you were out here in Vancouver, but I remember, you know, you were submitting people from bottom side control before it was cool, before buggy chokes had taken over the internet. And I remember having to be extremely careful rolling with you because you would just straight up let me pass your guard and then choke me out from bottom side control. And there's a lot of things like that about your game specifically that I would say are crazy unique and crazy innovative and different. I'd love to talk a little bit about that. And maybe just to give me an update here, describe your game and what you currently, how you like to train these days and what kind of stuff you're doing.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I like to pride myself on being a little unorthodox. I think a lot of what I do is really based on still the principles of jiu-jitsu. I think what I do is kind of just like a physical pun. I'm doing very standard classic things, but like just from an inverted position, a lot of like what like I call like platypus guard, my bottom side control is really like a judo side from the top. And I actually constantly hate on judo side because you don't have the underhook. But when I'm on the bottom, I feel like I don't just, it clicks a little better for me when I'm underneath someone than it does on top.
Right, right. Now, I would ask here, one of the things that's very different about you and me is that, you know, you're a lot taller than me. I think you're like a foot taller than me. And I wonder, for that kind of game plan, because I know you do a lot of that, you are very capable at attacking from, say, bottom side control. Is that something that you think you're able to do specifically because of particular attributes or body dimensions? Or do you think that kind of thing is workable across the board if you just go ahead and study it?
Well, I've kind of been told that my whole life, that like every time I roll with someone, they say, oh my goodness, you're so long. And I didn't work my whole life to be long. It's like, for me, I think most of it is angles. I think being long gives you the ability to get into some positions easier. But then I think a short guy has an advantage because when he gets to that position, the choke is already tight. He has an easier time tightening out, I think. Everyone has advantages and disadvantages to being long or short, whether it's getting into a position easier or being able to make it tighter. But I think from what I've seen teaching my unorthodox techniques across the board to students now, where I have like hundreds of students that come in, I'm seeing people with all body types doing this really unorthodox stuff and then seeing them learning it at white belt level is really interesting to watch the innovation from people who don't know that it's weird.
So this is what I really want to touch on with you here, because I think a lot of these arguments over, oh, this is weird, this isn't normal, this isn't standard, I think a lot of these arguments come from a place of traditionalism. And these arguments are not so much being made because something does or doesn't work, but they're being made more because something is or isn't traditional. You know, I think there is definitely a bias in jiu-jitsu towards doing things the old way, you know, the way that we all learned it from UFC 1 and 4th. And I think there's an uphill battle if you're trying to ever introduce something that's different. I mean, I know that, of course, there was success in introducing leg locks and leg entanglements to the jiu-jitsu game. But I do think that there is a bias towards copy-paste in terms of learning. And I hear this a lot. When you see people do something that's kind of outside of the box, people will often say, oh, well, that's not high percentage. And of course, when you say high percentage, I mean, what exactly does that mean? We had a whole conversation with Robert Deagle recently where he challenged the notion of what high percentage means, and that people kind of have a warped understanding of what it means to be high percentage. And I would say that probably a lot of, I mean, yes, there are techniques that are classic and timeless, right? Like arm bars and such. But there are also things that probably we only really train a lot because they're traditional and they were passed down from instructor to instructor. And arguably, a lot of these things probably don't even work that optimally at the end of the day. I mean, an example I would give is most gyms to this day will start off most of their beginner white belts with closed guard. Whereas I think there's an emerging train of thought now that actually you should focus on open guard first. I would also say that a lot of the beginner sweeps, like scissor sweeps, for example, or hip bump sweeps, I would say that they're not necessarily the most efficient thing to be teaching white belts if you want to get them back on top. So I feel like a lot of these things that we accept as being the right way to do jiu-jitsu, people kind of only feel that because it's within their familiarity. And I think that there's always an uphill battle convincing people, if you're trying to innovate or do something unusual, there's always an uphill battle in convincing people that this actually works. So I'd love to get your thoughts on that. I mean, how do you approach this art of innovating? Because you mentioned that with your students, you've got your white belts doing pretty cool and crazy stuff by conventional standards. What does your class format kind of look like? And what's your process of innovation within the gym?
Well, for me, like for my class format, I start every class with flow rolls, which is should look exactly like jiu-jitsu, other than there's no submissions allowed and you shouldn't be in strength battle. So I always say, like, if someone, your goal is to go as smoothly and fastly as you can without power. So if someone gets ahead of you, you kind of just want to give up position, just scramble and just look to innovate. And I find when people roll without submissions on the table, they're much more likely to find new pathways and stuff and get to positions that they learn they like. Mm-hmm. So I start every class with flow rolls, and then we do technique for half an hour or 40 minutes, and then we roll to the death, or like we roll with submissions at the end of class. But I think it's important for guys kind of day one to do those flow rolls and feel what it's like to try and move and have someone make every decision you make wrong, and kind of know that you know nothing so that you can work from the ground up.
Yeah, it's almost like kind of throwing away all of the quote unquote rules and just encouraging people to experiment with the ideas. I've heard a lot of people talk about this recently, where rather than coming in and trying to prescribe techniques, I mean, this is kind of the way that I was taught, right? When I started out back in the 2000s, is you come in and your instructor just hits you up with a bunch of techniques and says, copy these, you know, do these exactly. But I think as of around the 2010s, maybe there's been a movement towards making jiu-jitsu classes less like a monkey see, monkey do approach and more kind of like a science lab, where you have people come in and you give them some ground rules about how body mechanics work, but then you kind of let them branch out and experiment on their own and figure out what works and what doesn't work on their own. And I think that there's a lot of pros to that approach. I'm sure there's also downsides as well, but it definitely does encourage your students to be a lot more inquisitive and look at jiu-jitsu more as like a laboratory of peers, where you're going in there and you're experimenting, and you know, you're not hung up on your ideas and you're not dogmatic. It's also a more fun culture in my mind when you look at jiu-jitsu like a lab where people go in and experiment, versus where if you look at it in a traditional sense where the instructor is just barking out orders to the students.
Yeah, 100%. I think in the olden days, people used to train their whole life in one gym and not really go around. And now people that are more our age have spent time in so many different gyms, they kind of realize, like, oh, wow, there's a million different ways to do this. And it kind of really is what you make of it. And so once you have enough people do a Kimura to you that's a little different, and they tell you that it's the way, I think you start to realize, like, everyone has a way of making their own. I have a couple students who are like airplane mechanics and just like tinkerers. And if you just give them an end goal, they're very good at like figuring out how to get there. And so I try and just show people the positions they want to get to, ways that I get to it, movements I use, but I'm always trying to leave room for creativity, because there's, when you have athletes come from different sports, sometimes they know a movement that's like a hack that you just never saw because you were doing it with just jiu-jitsu people. And sometimes an MMA guy comes in and shows you something where you're like, oh, that's a great option.
Yeah. I mean, anyone who has had someone from another art come into their gym probably understands exactly what you're talking about. I mean, if you are, you know, a jiu-jitsu person and you've got some decent level judokas come into your gym, you will learn so much from them just because they have a very different set of knowledge coming in and they roll in a completely different way. There's a totally different energy that you get from rolling with a judoka or from a wrestler. And I think that kind of cross training and like cross pollination of ideas becomes increasingly important. I don't know about you, but I find as I get older, I find it harder to try new things. And I, you know, maybe this is just me being old and getting stuck in my ways, but I remember, you know, when I was a white belt, I mean, you're like a sponge, right? Everything is new, totally open mind, totally open beginner's mind. You don't have any preconceived notions of how a fight is supposed to work, really. So you just kind of go with the flow. But I find that when you get to black belt, you know, you've got a lot of accumulated knowledge and experience and habits as well, right? And habits can be good or bad depending on how you built them. And I find it does, when you have an existing framework of how you spar, I find it personally harder to introduce new things. And I find I have to work harder at doing it because I've got so much of a foundation that already exists. And I would ask if you feel the same way or if you've got any suggestions for people to break out of that mindset so that they can start being creative again if they're kind of older and set in their ways.
Yeah, I do. I think it's really important to roll with what I call is like a blank slate mentality. Like an example I use is when I first started going to 10th Planet Coquitlam, which is now 10th Planet Vancouver, and Nabil Salameh would guillotine me or heel hook me multiple times every single round. And I could have just tried to not go to those positions when I rolled with Nabil and learned to have 0-0 rounds with him. But I always try to roll with every opponent, slap hands, bump fists, and then just roll and only go based off of the movements and the feels that you get in that roll. So it meant for me going into those same traps, if that's what I was going to do, because I was not rolling with Nabil like Nabil. I was rolling with Nabil just as another body. And so eventually I learned to battle in those positions and even try to catch him in those positions. But it took me a year or two of getting submitted all the time, because that was apparently a weakness in me that I had for someone with Nabil's body and style that I wouldn't have solved if I was trying to beat Nabil. I would have just learned how to roll with Nabil, but I wouldn't have fully learned all of those things. So I really try when I'm rolling with people, that is my goal every roll, is to just pretend I don't know who I'm rolling with and just make their decisions wrong. I don't even try and fight their decisions. I try and let them make decisions and then make them wrong. And I think that allows me to constantly be in new positions where almost every role I have someone say, oh, I've never been in that position before.
Yeah, I love that mindset, because it is very easy for your jiu-jitsu game to solidify and calcify, right? Especially if you're training with the same people over and over again. And to me, that's actually one of the most important reasons to cross train and, you know, go around, see how other gyms do things. It's not necessarily because they're going to have some secret knowledge that you just have never seen before, but a big part of it is because people that you don't know will give you different energy and they'll expose weaknesses to your game that you haven't seen before. I mean, if you train with the same buddies over and over and over again, you become so attuned to each other's games that unless you take really, really aggressive action to change it, you kind of just fall into the same sparring routine every single time. And I've noticed that happens actually a lot with me and some of my buddies that I've been training with for years, is that like, fuck, all of our roles wind up looking exactly the same. Just the same thing shakes down every single time. And I guess that's okay for burning calories and getting a workout in, but it's really probably not the best way for skill development. And, you know, as a hobbyist who has a lot of limitations on where and how often I can train, this is probably the biggest frustration I have, is that it's hard for me to go outside of my comfort zone because I just don't have the capacity to do a lot of traveling for jiu-jitsu. But I think that ability to kind of reset your mind is really interesting. And I'd love to explore that a little bit. Like, how do you do that? I mean, you and Nabil as a perfect example. We've been training together for years, probably rolled together hundreds, if not thousands of times. How do you walk into a role like that and reset your mind so that you can come in like a blank slate and just train like you're both white belts who don't know each other?
I don't know if like everyone does that. I really like, that's a conscious effort I've made in my whole life of grappling. And that's why I think I genuinely love every moment of grappling, because I like, it allows me like to be super creative, but I like, it's work. I have to like constantly think about it. And you have to be able to drop the, like, I was a professional MMA fighter who's a purple belt. When I started rolling with Nabil, I was 50, 60 pounds bigger than him. It's not easy on the ego to get beat at something that you're trying to be the best at. And then it's a hard practice to like tell your ego to shut up. And this is a long run sort of thing. But I would drive home in silence sometimes from practice with Nabil, just being like, well, we're going to figure this out. But it's not like, I think a lot of people have a hard time like battling their own ego. But to me, you're not doing jiu-jitsu if you're doing jiu-jitsu with someone you know and you're anticipating what they're going to do. That's just a dance. You're just dancing in a jiu-jitsu outfit. But jiu-jitsu to me is going against someone you don't know and trying to anticipate what they're going to do or make them do something that they didn't want to do. But jiu-jitsu is only jiu-jitsu when you're nervous and scared and you don't know the person. To me, I don't like jiu-jitsu against jiu-jitsu people is almost not jiu-jitsu. Like, jiu-jitsu to me is like almost has to be proven in the MMA fight, because that's when you have the stand up and just get out of your guard. People are so used to when you have guard on someone that the other person is just playing guard now. But that's not what some people are going to do. Some people are just going to get up and walk away or punch you. Or I love the creativity that comes with being able to be as blank slate as you can. I rolled today with a 13-year-old kid who is fairly new to jiu-jitsu, and I got a wicked sweat in. I rolled with a 250-pound black belt in the roll before, who I didn't sweat as much with, and I didn't see as many positions, and I would argue I did less jiu-jitsu with him because we were just in stagnant battles.
Yeah, you fall into kind of an almost choreographed routine against some buddies of yours. And I like that you bring that up, because it's something that I haven't thought about much, which is this problem of how, you know, we all know that jiu-jitsu is all about going outside of your comfort zone and learning and growing from that discomfort. That's supposed to be one of the reasons we do this. But as human beings, we seek comfort and we seek familiarity. And I think that once you start going past blue belt into purple, brown, black, jiu-jitsu, instead of being the scary thing that you do to kind of go outside of your comfort zone, if you've been doing it long enough, it actually becomes your comfort zone. And going in and just getting a sweat in and rolling with your buddies just becomes kind of like your social club. And I think that's kind of where that whole joke about purple belts not showing for warmups comes up, right? And I mean, there's truth to that. You know, it's very common when you go to a gym that the purple belts kind of just roll in whenever. And like, don't even get me started on the brown and the black belts. Sometimes they don't even roll. They just show in and they just chat like it's a social club, right? It very much becomes your comfort zone. And I think that it does take a bit of a nudge to push yourself outside of that mentality once you kind of fall into that, because you're right, at that level, If it's just you and your buddies going through the motions and just kind of executing the same sequence of techniques that you always do against each other, you basically wind up turning it into like a pro wrestling match. It's kind of almost a choreographed dance at that point, right down to the point where often the outcome is the same. And I think that that's a trap that most people who have a few years under their belt run the risk of falling into, unless they deliberately shake things up. So I like the mentality here that you're bringing about trying to kind of reset your mind and go back to being a white belt and go back to just kind of looking at things like a clean slate.
Yeah, to me, it's like so important. I have the benefit right now of having a room that is like constantly growing and high level guys from all sorts of different backgrounds are there. So I'm having to do less of a mental blank slate because I'm literally rolling with brown and black belts who I don't know every day. So it's been very good for me doing that. But I always preach that to the guys because they will sometimes ask me about how I'm able to be so creative. And then they talk about how they get stagnant with their students. But you need to, yeah, I think if you work on that blank slate mentality, you can, it doesn't matter who you're with, you should be able to get as good of a role as you could with yourself.
So something I want to dig into here on the topic of creativity. I mean, it's fine to be creative, and I think it's actually good for kind of your emotional state to be creative. I think it brings a lot of positive energy to the room. But the question that a lot of the number nerds are always going to ask is, oh, well, what about competition at the highest levels, right? This is something that I hear a lot where people act like they're statisticians and they basically won't even show interest in something unless it's been demonstrated to work at elite level competition, which I totally get, right? I totally understand. For the majority of people who are just looking to get value out of this sport quickly, it makes sense to look at what the best are doing and just basically copy and steal as much of that as possible. But I think beyond a certain level of experience, you need to start thinking about innovating and breaking free from that. And the pushback I always hear when people try to be creative is they will immediately start shitting on these new things because there isn't a proven track record. So some examples would be, I mean, your stuff is a good example. Preet Mikkelsen from Estonia does a lot of very unorthodox defensive stuff. And the pushback he always gets is, well, we never see this at the highest level, so it must be crap. But the reality is, whenever you're trying to innovate something, just by definition, you're doing something new, right? If you're doing something new, there's no data to demonstrate that it works. So I would ask you then, how do you blend this? Because you also compete both in MMA and in jiu-jitsu quite a bit. How do you blend this fact that you're doing these unproven things and take them into these tournaments? Like when you go and there's real stakes on the line, do you bust out all of that creative unproven stuff or do you stick to what's tried and true?
I think it's a little bit of both, right? Like I'm reading this book right now called Algorithms to Live By, where it's talking about how to like sort different things and how to figure it out. And you need to have room to test your creativity. And then in the tournament, you want to do the higher percentage stuff, obviously. But I have the benefit of being someone who is young enough and competitive enough that I'm out there kind of blazing my own trail. So if I've done a triangle defense that I know works inside the room, I've tested it on different people of different levels, and I've gone to different rooms. If I'm in a match at Submission Underground and I get put in a triangle, I'm gonna without hesitation go to a creative thing that I know has worked, because one, I know just from my own point of view that it works really well. But I also know that that's the major benefit for being creative and doing new stuff is I'm very confident when I do some of my things. That person hasn't seen it. And if they have seen it, they haven't seen it in the way that I'm going to do it. I have weird patterns that I've built into pretty good little like step-by-step plans that I can dig myself out of holes and put myself in really good position with pretty unorthodox steps that I am very confident in. And I don't believe that people practice problem solving at a fast level that much. They're doing the dance of jiu-jitsu with their friends, and I'm trying to constantly problem solve. So I fail a lot. I get into bad positions. Sometimes I tap. I try to make it a point to go to positions that you tap in practice. We do EBI overtime rounds where we start in an armbar or in the back, where I make a point to tell my students, like, I'm going to tap here because I'm going to try my hardest to get out as many times as I can from the back. And that is going to involve me taking risks, and I'm just going to bank those in my head. And then hopefully I don't try one of those in a tournament when it matters, but I can know that it's crossed off the list because I tried it.
Right. Well, how do you know when, I mean, you talked about how you do things in the gym enough to get confidence that they're going to work, but, you know, presumably there's different levels, right? When you are doing things in the gym, you've got a whole variety of training partners of different levels of experience and such that you can do this against. But I mean, I've seen some of your competitive matches. You've been in there with like Craig Jones. How do you know if a technique is sufficient enough that you can deploy it against someone like that? Because presumably that you got to be really confident in something to go for it against someone of that caliber. How do you know when you're training with, you know, mere mortals in the gym that you've gotten something to the point that, okay, this is good enough that I could use it against someone like Craig?
Well, you're trying to use your A game in the competition. So a lot of like the defensive creativity stuff I do, I wouldn't get put in those positions in the gym if I didn't like voluntarily go to very bad positions and try and work myself out. Kind of how like Gary Tonin has that mentality of trying to like work your way through instead of trying to avoid. But I try not to have to use any of my funk in competition. If I can just take someone down with a double leg and Kimura them, that's a great win. I just trust my instincts because I've done it over and over again. It's just denial and error. I've put thousands and thousands of hours on the mat. Since I was 12 years old, I've spent most of my waking hours trying to grapple, and I'm pretty confident that I'm going to be able to solve it. And it definitely doesn't work sometimes. Craig Jones. But in that Craig Jones match, I learned something because I didn't use that mentality. Nabil kind of has a man crush on Craig Jones, and that was right when Craig was getting first famous, and we like watched a lot of tape on him, and I, in the match, felt like he was going to my legs, and I only felt that because I had watched video, and I wasn't in the moment. I was in the back watching tape. He was going to my back. I feel like if I would have just been grappling blank slate, I would have just been aware of what was happening, but instead I tried to anticipate, and you can't anticipate someone else's movements. You need to just make them do things and know what they're going to do.
So that's a fascinating point. This idea that by studying this guy, you actually kind of put your own thoughts in a box and you wound up in a situation where you anticipated that your opponent would zig, but he actually wound up zagging and doing something totally different. Do you think that there's a limitation or some restrictions around how people do things like tape study, or is that even something that might be detrimental? Or do you think there's maybe a way that you can study your opponent without falling into that trap?
Yeah, I think you definitely can. I think I didn't. In that, I think, I don't know, like you couldn't turn your brain off and shoot a basketball unless you had learned how to shoot a basketball. But at a certain point, like you just have to be in the flow and shoot. Like if someone tells you, oh, you just made 20 shots in a row, the next shot doesn't become harder, but now you're thinking about other things. You're thinking about external things. And I really pride myself on trying to be in the moment, and I definitely learned a good lesson there. I feel like I had already kind of known that lesson. I thought I had learned that lesson through MMA, but I didn't. I needed to learn it again, but I feel like that helped cement it. I would definitely learn what someone is good at and try to learn to do it more than I would to defend. I feel like I'm good at learning defenses by learning the offense fully.
Right. Now, something you mentioned prior was that you practice these things enough that you get confident in them. And that's when you know it's like, okay, this is good to go. We've done this thousands of times. I have confidence in my technique here. And this thing I'm doing is kind of unorthodox and different. I have confidence that I can deploy this in a high stakes match. I would ask here, and this is something I've kind of been trying to get my head around, how much do you think confidence factors into whether something is good or not in the first place. I mean, do you think that confidence is kind of one of the key variables in making things work? I mean, if you were just like really, really diligent, for example, in practicing buggy chokes, and you know, you did those thousands of times and you had confidence in your ability to do that, do you think that that's enough to make a technique like work at a high level? Or do you think there's more to it than just, I got in the reps and I have the confidence in it? Do you think that maybe some moves are just fundamentally better than others? Or can confidence actually close that gap and turn low percentage things into high percentage things?
Both. Some moves are definitely better than others, but you can, there is so much that goes on in a match that is just in the people's mind that sometimes the crowd never catches on to, or even some competitors, sometimes the competitors in the match don't even realize, but there is times when you can just not believe in a choke and you can somehow survive in it. And then there can be times when you just feel like that choke is tighter than it is and you can start to fall asleep. Like, your brain is so powerful, both positive and negative, that I know that I've been in triangle chokes where I'm using a defense that I know is foolproof. And I've been in a position where, like, I feel like I should have gone to sleep, but I knew that I could, like, just meditate in the end of that tunnel and I wouldn't die and I could just go to a place where I could, like, stay calm. But if you can't stay calm and you start to question it, it goes away right away. You see that in fights. Like, it's not like Anderson Silva got worse at fighting after he lost once. He just lost his confidence. And then his opponents didn't buy into it anymore. Like, there was an aura about him where people felt like they were going to get knocked out and he'd hit them and their brain would just like, that's it. And they would just give up. But then once they saw Chris Weidman knock him out and survive, all of a sudden we're like, he's not invincible. And his aura was gone. But that's just a confidence thing. You can find ways to get that back. You see people lose it and get it back. But yeah, 100% that you can just be confident in a move and you can make it work. I feel like if someone has judo side control on you and you don't believe that it can be a good position because you know they don't have the underhook, you can just eventually get to their back. But if for a second you feel like, oh no, he might actually get me with this, they start getting those Kesa Katamis and all sorts of moves from there that maybe shouldn't work, but you bought into it for a second too long.
It is interesting because it kind of goes into the power of belief there, right? Which is that any technique can work if you can convince your opponent to believe it's going to work. And I've definitely felt this before where I have sparred with people and either I've done something totally crazy that shouldn't work or they've done it to me. But after a while, you know, the person getting stuck in the technique realizes, oh shit, this is not what I thought it was, you know, and there becomes a sense of panic, like, I'm going to get stuck in this crazy thing. And then they realize, oh shit, I've never been in this position before. So I have no context for what I'm supposed to do when someone does this kind of thing. And it does kind of get into your head at that point. And the more you get into your head, it does start to become a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? If you think you're going to get stuck somewhere, it's going to happen. You're going to convince yourself that that's true one way or the other.
100%. And resilience is a skill, just like everything else. And people, if you haven't constantly spent your life trying to figure out new creative ways to get in out of a situation, if you're in a situation where you don't have an answer, you're going to start panicking. But if you know that you can figure out answers because you've constantly made it your goal to just not have an answer and an answer will appear, if you have the confidence that you can have an idea will appear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting. We were talking to Brandon McCaffron, you know, same sort of lineage as you under the 10th planet system a few episodes back. And I asked him, you know, why is it that you think the 10th planet system, so to speak, hasn't really bled through into other areas of the art? You know, why is it that you don't see things like rubber guard getting pulled off in a lot of IBJJF or tournaments or in ADCC? Is it because these techniques just don't work? Or is it because of some other reason? And what Brandon said is like, look, I mean, rubber guard is not a silver bullet. It's not going to solve every single problem, but it does have a place. And his stance was that in the past, it's not so much that the technique did or didn't work, but it's that because of the state of development the 10th planet was at, they just hadn't created enough ambassadors, right? You know, you've got to have some elite level athletes out there demonstrating this stuff. But then eventually, once these techniques start to establish a bit of an aura and you see something working at a higher level, suddenly the mentality totally shifts, and things that were thought to be impossible or unlikely before suddenly start to become very common. I mean, some examples I can give in my journey, you know, you and I came up around the same time. So I'm sure you remember the disparaging talk about leg locks back when we started. I mean, people used to laugh at the idea of leg locks in jiu-jitsu. I used to have black belts tell me, like, no one good ever taps to a leg lock because, that's just like the coward's way out. You know, they don't really hurt. They don't really do any damage. And that really just came from a position of ignorance when people said that. I would also say some other things that I had been told. You know, I came up under the belief that the Kimura was a big guy's move. And so I never really studied it. But then, you know, in the 2010s or so, the Kimura trap system evolved, and suddenly people realized, okay, you don't need to use this thing just to twist the person's arm behind their back and get a tap. You can use this to advance control. Like, you can use it as a guard pass if you do it right. And that totally changed the perspective. And now you see little guys doing this stuff all the time, which would have been thought of to be very unlikely before. I mean, I think Marcelo Garcia famously said that the Kimura was a big man's move. And I think most people would argue that now. I wonder, in your experience, are there any other things that you look at as jiu-jitsu myths? Things that people think are true, but actually probably they're not, or maybe they're primed to be busted? Just, I'd love to know, because you're a pretty creative guy. If you've explored this stuff and have found anything else that you think people just have common misconceptions about.
I think you do see a lot of 10th planet techniques done at the high level in IBJJF, and guys just rip it off and make new names for it. And like, I'm sure there's a lot of 10th planet stuff that has names that's been done in other systems before too, but like, you see people using lockdown in the highest levels. You see people using rubber guard. Like, didn't Keenan Cornelius put out a whole thing on gubber guard, which is rubber guard in the gi? And like, you see Mason Fowler, you like teaching rubber guard techniques. I think you see rubber guard pretty often at a high level now, but I don't know if it's like, if you see subs out of it all the time, but there's definitely 10th planet techniques that came up and were developed through the 10th planet system that you see all the time in high-level IBJJF tournaments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm personally a huge fan of the lockdown, right? I'm not a 10th planet guy, and I admittedly haven't studied the system that much, but the lockdown is something that has been a staple of my game since white belt. And, you know, the common criticism, I think a lot of the time people like to build up these straw man arguments about these positions. Like, the example I always heard with lockdown is, well, it's not a good position because you don't want to be flat on your back with both of your shoulders pinned, with your opponent cross facing you. You don't want with them about to pass your guard. So why would you play lockdown? Because that's not a good position to put yourself in. And to that, my answer is, duh. I mean, that doesn't mean you necessarily need to pull lockdown on someone. But if you find yourself in that position where your half guard is about to get passed, in my mind, lockdown is one of the best options you might have. I mean, if you're already stuck there and your shoulders are already pinned to the mat and this guy's got a cross face on you, why not use lockdown? It's right there, right? You're already in the position. You don't need to use that tool when it's not appropriate. But when it is appropriate, like, let's acknowledge that these tools exist and that they might have a purpose. Maybe they're not perfect, but they probably do have a place. And I kind of wonder how much other stuff we just dismiss out of hand because we don't see someone win, like, worlds with that technique. I think there's kind of a bias that jiu-jitsu people have where unless someone has won a world championship with it repeatedly, we don't even consider the technique as being valid.
Well, I'd also like to say, like, if you're using half guard in no gi, it is about to get passed. So you should switch to lockdown because in the gi, a half guard can make a lot of sense. But if you're in no gi, you need to be in lockdown if you're in that position. And I would agree, you never want to be flat on your back, but I don't think anyone would teach you to be in lockdown and hang out flat on your back.
Yeah, I think that's kind of an example of where people misunderstand the intent, right? No one is saying that you should slap hands, bump fists at the beginning of the roll, and then dive into lockdown, right? It's more a position of opportunity. And I think a lot of positions are like that, where they're just tools, right? There is a time and a place to use them. Just because they're not effective in every conceivable situation doesn't mean they're bad. I mean, nothing is.
Yeah, in my opinion, you should want to be on top of the person and in control. Like, you don't ever want to be in a vulnerable position. But if you're in a vulnerable position, you should be using a smart position that is making contact with as much of their body as you can so that they don't have the ability to create angles.
Got it. Now, are there any other myths out there that you think we can bust? You know, we talked about some examples of things that used to be conventional knowledge and were kind of disproven in the jiu-jitsu scene. Anything that's happening right now in the competitive landscape that you think is just ripe for disruption, where maybe people are not doing things in an optimal way and there's going to be a creative approach that comes out and proves it?
That's the thing about creativity, is a lot of you don't see it coming. But I think I'm really liking the trend I'm seeing now of wrestling being integrated more. I know, like, when you and I started training constantly at practices, I would get looked at and our coach would say, we can't wrestle out of this situation. We need to use our mind. We need to think our way out.
What a shot at wrestlers that is. That implies that wrestlers are a bunch of dumb morons who don't think, which is absolutely not true.
No, wrestling was constantly, when I started, used as a derogatory term for, like, being a meathead. And then in my head, I was like, no, like, wrestling's been around for thousands of years and there's more things you can't do. So that means people are better at doing the things they can do because there's less options. So they're doing chains better. But I'm really liking how we're seeing wrestling kind of integrate its way back into jiu-jitsu. I think you should be able to just teach wrestling. Like, you should be able to teach double legs and hip tosses and throws, and it can be called jiu-jitsu. I hate that it has to be called wrestling to do that, because jiu-jitsu starts on the feet. It should be recognized as a jiu-jitsu technique to do a double leg, but it's not.
How much of that do you think comes down to just the points that we award people for their conduct? Because I always wonder how much of these limitations in jiu-jitsu actually come from rules that we've put on ourselves. I mean, one of the things about jiu-jitsu is, look, I can do a takedown and I get my 2 points, or I can pull guard, and if I sweep, I also get 2 points. So I don't really get punished if I would prefer to just scoot around on my butt. And that means that most people can just go ahead and do that, and they're not really putting themselves at a disadvantage. And I wonder if you think the rule sets that we participate under have kind of unconsciously altered the direction of the sport in a way that we don't like. Because I kind of wonder, look, if takedowns are worth 3 points, would we have this problem now where we are so disparaging of wrestlers and no one in jiu-jitsu knows how to do good takedowns? If we had reflected in the rule set accordingly that a takedown should be worth more than a sweep, do you think we'd be in a very different world?
I think at the higher level, it's starting to prove that you just need to do it. And I think people are going to realize you just can't get to the next level. You're always going to have those hobbyists. You're going to have the people who know who they're rolling with before class starts and they just do their little dance. But if you want to, like, get good at what jiu-jitsu is supposed to be, you need to wrestle. And I think eventually it will just be a very 3D sport. I think the sport has gone through its phase of kind of being sportish, and I think people are really, like, with things like combat jiu-jitsu and stuff, people are starting to see that, like, oh, maybe I should try and keep myself safe before I'm trying to be in this position where I could sneak away a few points. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do think the rule sets matter. I think I'm a big fan of in no-gi, how it's going a lot more towards submission only and really bringing it back to being about the submission, because there's nothing, I don't think it's the gi's fault that matches are boring. I think it's the guys who compete in the gi. I know that I have had exciting gi matches. People are going to be boring if they're rewarded for it, but I think we need to start creating more opportunity, especially for the gi to be exciting. And by doing that, they need to do, like, sub only, no time limit, or have creative things that they've done in no gi that make matches exciting.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about the gi is sparring in the gi is understandably pretty conservative. I mean, when someone can grab your pajamas and basically just paralyze you by grabbing onto you, you're going to learn to be very defensive and conservative and deny grips. But that can result in a lot of matches that look ultimately really stagnant, because basically one person pulls guard and then there's just a lot of jockeying for grips and nothing really exciting happens. And I mean, to some extent, I'm kind of on the fence as to whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. You know, I don't think a fight necessarily needs to be exciting to be effective and good for the sport. I mean, I definitely, of course, you know, it, in terms of the business side of things, it's better for jiu-jitsu if it's a spectator-friendly sport. But in terms of an effectiveness side of things, I mean, if it's a realistic combat strategy and it works, then so be it. I'd love to explore your mentality on that. You know, how important is it really that jujitsu be spectator friendly? You know, that's kind of a part of innovation. Usually the people who are really innovative and creative and unorthodox tend to be fan favorites because they're doing cool stuff that's fun to watch. That doesn't necessarily mean that they will win all the time. In fact, sometimes being super unorthodox works to their detriment. But I would ask you, as someone who does this competitively and professionally, both in a jiu-jitsu and an MMA sense, what is the importance of being a crowd pleaser in that sense, in being a fan favorite, beyond just the impact on the dollars and cents?
Well, I gotta say, it definitely doesn't make that much sense when you're sitting in the room after losing. But there's nothing more fun than winning in a new creative way. To me, it's the only reason I compete, is to go out and be exciting and try to like entertain myself. I admittedly don't watch very much jiu-jitsu. I feel like I would watch a lot of jiu-jitsu if people went at it with my mentality. And there's people that I will go out of my way to watch. Like if Andy Varela is competing, I will go out of my way to watch him compete. If I know someone is going to go after a win or that like highlight or die mentality, I'm a big fan of it, but it gets rewarded much more in jiu-jitsu than it does in MMA. And I think that's why you see characters develop where there's fan favorites who don't necessarily win every match, but they're always exciting. You have guys like Jeff Glover who are just so exciting and entertaining, and people aren't there to like find out what his win-loss record is, and like that's not what it's about. But for sports like MMA, it becomes very hard to get competitions when you don't have a good record. Like I'm in MMA purgatory where I know that I am a hard fight for people. They know that I'm a hard fight for them. But now that I don't have a good record because I've taken chances and it hasn't paid off, now people just won't even take the risk to fight me because it won't put them in the UFC if they beat me, and they feel like fighting me should reward them with getting in the UFC.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I get that. And I think that's where that kind of conservatism comes into play in terms of picking your fights, picking your strategies, calling your shots, right? I mean, we don't reward creativity and innovation a lot of the time in jiu-jitsu. And so what winds up happening is, yes, people will kind of default to playing the safest game possible to try to like rack up the maximum results for themselves, which makes perfect sense. I mean, I'd never criticize anyone for doing that, right? For doing what they have to do to win. But I do think that there is that element of joy and play that is important in jiu-jitsu beyond just wins and losses. And I think that as you get older and you get past your competitive prime and jiu-jitsu becomes more of like a lifestyle and a practice, I think the importance of finding joy in it and playing and trying new things becomes a lot more important than just racking up wins and losses, right? That competitive phase of your jiu-jitsu career in a sport that, you know, a lot of people do until they're 60 or 70 or even later, that competitive phase is just a small part of it. And I think that there's a lot of time beyond that where focusing on creativity and play and just having fun and experimenting becomes more important.
Yeah, I agree. The whole sport to me is about creativity. I try not to lose that even when I'm in the heat of battle. But I think the only way to make your students be that way is to be that way at all times. So I feel like our gym at 10th Planet Etobicoke is like the funnest room in the entire world, because as a top-down society, we are concentrating on having fun first, and it's fun to be creative and successful. So obviously your goal is still to win. Your goal is in new creative ways. Like it's fun to be able to say, look what I did, and have us all try and figure it out and workshop it together and find out if there's a move there. That's what it's all about to me.
Yeah. Makes tons of sense. Now, a problem that I've had, and I suspect a lot of listeners will have, is that they want to try something different. Maybe they want to experiment, but they're not in an environment that's conducive to that, right? I've definitely had this, and this is a battle that I'm currently struggling with now, which is that, look, my leg lock game is really not very good. I mean, I'm pretty good at not letting someone get me. Like you were talking about this earlier. I'm pretty good at defensively avoiding the situation and denying leg entanglements, but I suck at going into leg entanglements. If I do get into a leg entanglement and someone has my leg, I suck at getting out of it. And I would love to kind of park everything and focus on, okay, I want to work on just this aspect of the game. game. But to some extent, you're also kind of bound by the constraints around you. I mean, I train primarily in the gi. I train primarily with people who are interested in IBJJF rules. So the challenge that I often find is what I want to train might not align with what my training partners want me to train. So, you know, they might say, look, we're training in the gi, so no toe holds, no heel hooks, blah, 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 blah. How do you deal with that? Or what do you suggest to people in that position if they want to branch out and expand their jiu-jitsu, but the training partners and the environment around them isn't really conducive to that?
Yeah, that's a, I don't know. Like, I think if you're like, I know that you're in a city like Vancouver where there's just gyms everywhere. So it's an easy option just to go to other places, but you have to take charge of your role. So you have to just make what role you want happen. But if you're in a place that is stifling creativity, that's, and you want to be creative, you're in the wrong place. I think it's very important to make a room that is for everyone, and everyone can do that. If you're, I don't know, I think it's just finding a different class if you're in this class that's like that every time.
Yeah, that makes sense. And hey, like, nothing against gyms that want to focus on a certain rule set. There's some gyms that are quite clearly trying to funnel their competitors towards the gi. There's also gyms that are quite clearly trying to funnel their competitors towards, you know, things like EBI rules. That's all well and good. But sometimes, like you said, you've got to take ownership of your own path. If you're just not in a gym that is interested in building up the skill set that you want to build up, I mean, that's where things like what you did, where you kind of branched out and pursued a second black belt, actually make a lot of sense, because that forces you into a brand new environment. And sometimes the environmental context makes all the difference, right? You train in a different room with people who have different goals. And if those goals align more closely with yours, it might just be easier to get where you need to go at the end of the day.
Yeah, just like with everything, set and setting is very important. Like, you need to be in a place where you're inspired, otherwise you're stagnant. And I don't understand why you would pay to go somewhere to be stagnant. You can do that at home.
Most definitely. Well, Micah, I would just ask you here before we tie up, any closing thoughts, anything you want to talk about on this topic of innovation, being unorthodox and creative, anything that we didn't already get into here today?
No, I think it's just really important to find a place where your teachers are very okay with you doing interesting things and asking questions. And if your teacher is telling you that you can't cross train, I think you need to like recognize that as a red flag. I think it's dying now, but people still don't like their students. If you're afraid your student is going to leave you for another teacher, then that's on you. But like, you should encourage people to be doing jiu-jitsu in other places and bringing it into your environment. Because I know, like, as a teacher, I actually don't have a lot of time to go to other gyms because I am in my gym every day, multiple times a day, running class. So it's like imperative for me to have guys going out to other people and be like, hey, look what this guy showed me the other day. Like, hey, what do you think of this? Like, that's the only way I can grow, because I'm not able to go to a bunch of different gyms because I'm in one place every day. But I feel like a lot of gyms still have that environment where the teacher is like hesitant about you going to other places. And I think that should be a red flag. I think cross training and going to different gyms is really important. It doesn't have to be just when you're traveling. You should make friends at tournaments and go and visit their gym. And if there's a drop-in fee, then pay that drop-in fee and learn. Like, it's jiu-jitsu should be about building community and learning to be more creative.
Yeah, I think that especially if you're a new person, but really anyone who's looking for a new gym, if they're telling you that you can't cross train right out of the gate, that's almost always a universal red flag for the gym for a variety of reasons, right? At the most benign, like you said, it's going to mean that your game gets stifled because you're not getting exposed to new ideas. You're kind of living in a bubble. But even beyond that, it's an example of your instructor trying to exert control over your life and your own decision making. And like, look, if they're willing to exert control in that way, there could be a lot of other really gross, awful things that they try to do. So usually that's one of the most immediate and obvious red flags for a gym, is if the instructor doesn't let their students cross train, probably that means it's time to find another gym. We get a lot of got fan mail about this. And that, I mean, that's almost always my advice, is if your instructor tells you you can't cross train, you probably need to find a new instructor.
Yeah, 100%. It's definitely becoming much more common today to see people training at multiple gyms. But I think competing as early as you can is super important. People always ask me when the right time to start competing is. And to me, if you waited until you got your, if you somehow got your black belt without ever competing, you'd still be a white belt at competing that first day you did it. So you need to just compete. You need to be able to drop your ego. That's most of what jiu-jitsu is about, is just learning how to deal with your ego and figure out what's the most reasonable, safe thing to do.
Yeah, makes sense. Well, with all that said, Micah, if people want to follow you, check out your stuff, how do they go about doing that? Where can they find you?
Yeah, I'm on like Instagram and Twitter. So everything's just Micah Brakefield. My name, I'm old enough that I was like the first person with those. So everything right from my email to any social media will always just be Micah Brakefield.
Awesome. Cool. And I'll put those links in the show notes so that if anyone wants to look you up, follow you, they can do that pretty easily. But yeah, it was good to catch up, man. Greatly appreciated. Always a fun chat. I think this is a cool topic and one that I always love digging into, because I think that creativity and being willing to try new things, even if it doesn't always work out, just the spirit of being willing to experiment and to deal with the consequences of that is always so important to the growth of this sport. So great chat, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, cool. And I'll be seeing you in a few weeks. Actually, I'll be in Vancouver at the beginning of July. I'm gonna come to Ascension.
Oh, awesome! You can come and pretzel me from that side control position, that platypus thing that you do.
Absolutely.
You're the only person I train with that I am afraid to take side control on, because I know I'm going to get fucked up from there.
Fly into Pearson Airport. You can now find a place where there's like 400 people that it is scary to enter side control at my gym.
Yeah, you were doing the whole attack from side control thing before these buggy choke idiots made it cool. So you're definitely a trailblazer in that capacity. But anyway, as always, to everyone listening, thanks a ton. If you want more of our stuff, I think most people know, but you can go to bjjmentalmodels.com. All of the podcast episodes, all of the articles we've written, access to the newsletter, everything is linked out from there. And of course, the next step up from that is our premium service. If you want to check that out, premium.bjjmentalmodels.com. In addition to supporting the show, there's over 50 hours of awesome content on there. Plus, that's how you get access to things like our coaching service and our community. Free trial, so highly do recommend you check that out if you haven't. Premium.bjjmentalmodels.com is how you do it. Would really appreciate it if everyone at least gives it a shot. Thanks a lot for that. And of course, thanks to you, Micah, for coming by and hanging out. Greatly appreciated. And thanks to all of the listeners, too, who hang out as well. Also greatly appreciated. Talk to you guys next week. Thanks a lot, Micah. Really had fun catching up.
All right, thank you.
All right, take care, buddy. Bye.